The precedent behind the Kyle Rittenhouse trial was a potentially grave one. Do normal Americans have the right to defend themselves, their family, and their meager property against state-sponsored communist goon squads, whose primary purpose was to terrorize the populace into silent submission? And as these terrorists raised entire urban areas to the ground, the corporate cronies of said state began their monopolizing of this scorched earth real estate at rock bottom prices. Expect this to be a common occurrence up until 2030. But the trial had another equally significant impact. It was the largest wake-up call for the majority of Americans into realizing that their long-established pre-internet news sources have devolved into mere propaganda for hire outfits, amoral mouthpieces for the highest bidder, at whatever cost to the general public, of whom they obviously couldn't care less. If it bleeds, it leads, has been their motto for longer than I have been alive. Of those who did not watch the trial, who did not bother to investigate the case for themselves, but rather lent sole faith into the aforementioned establishment media to describe the case for them, they got every single fact wrong. Be it the events that occurred, be it Kyle's character or his motives, all of it false, 100%. Those who are calling the verdict unjust are either delusional fools at best or lying race riot agitators at worst. Now, I'm not going to bother with the details of the case, for this is not the purpose for my video. There are plenty of reliable independent content creators who have sufficiently covered this already. Many of you are now just waking up to the fact that traditional journalism, on the surface and in the spotlight, is dead. But through my personal experiences, I had to face this tragic truth 20 years ago, as one who was once employed in establishment media. To explain my background in journalism, I must start from when the inspiration at first hit me. Since a young teenager, I've been a firm believer in the importance of journalistic integrity and the media's responsibility in the open dissemination of impartial knowledge so that the public may accurately measure the merit of policies proposed by the duly elected for outcomes beneficial for the common good, first and foremost, and above all, not limited to any special lobby or interest. Principles that now seem more to me utopian in cynical hindsight. Since a young teenager, I have desired to become an investigative journalist. After watching my beloved hometown descend into financial ruin and hopelessness, the generation before me had more job opportunities and the manpower to fulfill the seemingly endless demand. There were more homeowners than renters, and each family only required one weekly paycheck to thrive. There were more independent small businesses and franchises. Every storefront was occupied, and one homegrown factory employed four generations of my family. However, by the time I graduated high school, tragically, the effects of a new globalized economy were becoming apparent. Most of the factories that had once employed over a third of our town had been demolished. Out of 100 that once stood, only one still produces. We have no downtown anymore. Only a handful of the original mom and pops remain. And there is no coming back because the majority of the now empty storefronts are condemned. The only businesses that are thriving in our community, aside from the usual dozen big conglomerate chains, are the ones who keep the locals properly medicated, be it a hospital, a pot dispensary, a liquor store, or whichever gang is responsible for our fentanyl and meth epidemic. After years of wondering just what in the hell happened to my beloved community, I began to put the pieces together. The blight that ruined my town was the end result of an unholy marriage between multinational financial lobbyists and a uniparty political machine, whose every legislative decision had made it more profitable to outsource our jobs overseas than to ship the products that we once made back to us, but of a lower quality, a higher price, and tariff-free. To put this point more succinctly, I've learned through hard knocks that I must assume that every leader, in spite of all his flattery, charisma, and promises, is probably a rotten, lying prick who will abuse his station at every given opportunity in order to further his own wealth, glory, and power, and at whatever cost to those beneath him. That is, until his actions have proven otherwise. And even then, remember that every man has his threshold when it comes to temptation. And thus, I decided that my talents in sifting effectual wheat from the legislative chaff and rewording complex policies into simple layman's terms was my best chance at helping the American working class, of which my own family lineage had been so proudly a part of for 7 generations. And I am the first with a college degree. During the first term of George Bush Jr.'s presidency, I studied investigative journalism at a highly accredited school, a member of the 5-college consortium in the Berkshires of Massachusetts. My education included a minor focus in Occidental history, specifically on the rise and fall of the various democracies and republics that were tried throughout the Western world, and especially on the corruption, the undermining, and the juntas that led to their inevitable collapses, with tyranny as its replacement every single time. I also attended a special workshop hosted by a retired federal congressman who trained us in the art of extracting pertinent information from the flowery, self-serving PR jargon so often uttered in D.C. He warned us to regard every word from the mouths of these political elites with suspicion, for they are notorious in addressing just enough of the truth to avoid legal repercussion, but never enough to risk a tarnishing of their reputation among their faithful constituents, of whom they'd so often exploited behind closed doors, yet barely represented on the Capitol floor. Shortly after 9/11, I was an intern at a small publication, but a subsidiary of a very large parent firm. In college, I was being prepared for future editors to send me out on leads, knocking on doors, and confirming all hearsay as both credible and factually accurate before publication. Once hired, though, I quickly learned that my editors cared less about accuracy and more about whether a story would piss off our sponsors. And it became quite obvious that many corporate firms, political parties, and my direct employers were financially connected, when over 90% of the time that a whistle was blown, it was quickly dismissed by my middle management superiors. And I barely left the office. Outside of retrieving coffee orders, that is. And many apologists would ascribe this phenomenon to a budding internet potential that would make local traveling for interviews and confirming leads as an antiquated waste of valuable time, as the news cycles were quickly becoming smaller than the usual 24 hours. But these very same apologists had no further excuses to make when I confronted them with the fact that the majority of our stories were dictated to us in the form of press packages sent to us by fax or email, by those sponsors who kept our publication afloat through paid advertisements and donations. Even going so far as to instruct us, the journalists, on how to frame the story in whole paragraphs, which sloganeering phrases to use repeatedly, which topics to avoid, which subjects to spotlight, and with who to blame and with who to commend. But these press packages were already written by journalists outside of our publication, public relations journalists, to be specific. And I recall when a reputable professor of mine tried to personally warn me only a few years prior that PR journalism was becoming the fastest growing and most lucrative field. Whereas investigative journalism, the field that I was specializing in, was a dying one, and one that no major publication wanted to hire anymore. I stubbornly ignored his advice out of my young and dispirited principles, and I didn't realize the consequences until it was too late. And these consequences affected me right around the time that Colin Powell was showing off his little vial of yellow cake to the UN, making the case that Saddam Hussein was not only producing weapons of mass destruction, but planning on providing said WMDs to Al-Qaeda, Osama bin Laden's outfit, the ones supposedly responsible for the 9/11 terrorist attack. The only problem with this is, there was a recent intelligence report leak, one procured by an American military outfit, and I can't remember specifically which one at this time, but if a lowly intern at a small publication had read it, then why wouldn't the goddamn Secretary of State even know about it, or at least pretend to not know about it? The report was that Saddam Hussein went to great lengths in keeping Al-Qaeda recruitment agents out of Iraq, through methods of imprisonment and even execution, out of great fear that bin Laden's men could risk the fragile stability of his nation, further fomenting religious schisms between his Arab subjects specifically. Most people at the time did not realize just how much at ideological odds both Hussein and bin Laden were in. Both had very conflicting goals. Most people, that is, outside of government and military circles. Osama bin Laden dreamt of uniting all Muslims of the world, regardless of race or ethnicity, into one unifying caliphate. Saddam, however, dreamt of uniting all Arabs of the world, regardless of religious affiliation. That's because Saddam was an Arab supremacist, and his government was a secular one, even quasi-Marxist. This is why the majority of his cabinet, composed of Ba'athist Party officials, were Christians. This is why Saddam was happy to engage in a land-grabbing conflict with Iran, at the behest of a butthurt American administration, that is, because they were simply Persians occupying land destined for Arab conquest. This is why Saddam was persecuting the Kurdish minority in the north, because they were simply Kurdish. And although Saddam was raised Sunni, his persecution of the Shiite minority in Iraq had nothing to do with the religion and everything to do with the fact that most Shiites present in Iraq were also Persian and wanting annexation by Iran, the only Shiite-controlled nation at the time. Knowing that arming al-Qaeda with WMDs would have dire consequences for Saddam's own rule that expanded well beyond further wrath from the United States after overreaching in Kuwait, there were questions that Colin Powell needed to answer. Was there an actual benefit for Hussein to provide bin Laden with powerful weaponry that the Bush administration became recently aware of, especially one that made the intelligence leak antiquated or irrelevant? The problem was, at a time when this was most essential, a question that could have prevented America from being mired in yet another goddamn pointless bloody conflict for many years, and at a high cost to the working class and their children's future, nobody bothered to ask. Not one journalist. And after a heated argument with my editor to write an article on the subject, well, my journalism career had essentially ended before I had a chance to even land my first paid gig. My professional career in investigative journalism was short-lived, simply because my talents, and especially my principles, were no longer appreciated by the corporate media giants that define our current era in mass communication, acting more like a fourth governmental branch of a fascist regime than like the traditional fourth estate that once served a functioning republic. In hindsight, I realize now that I was becoming a relic even before I graduated. For corporate media hid behind the facade of traditional impartiality for as long as they could, which is to say, until the internet became sufficiently sophisticated in ripping that damn mask off its very punchable face. Because I was blacklisted before the internet developed the tools necessary in providing a lucrative career in alt media. I mean, this happened to me before MySpace was even a thing, for Christ's sakes. As opposed to now, for more fortunate millennials like Tim Poole, who had personally snubbed me in private conversation for merely employing my journalistic writing style into the making of short but impactful scripts for an adult-themed puppet show, rather than heroically riding the fence as he does, with his milquetoast self-censored commentary on other journalists' articles. Seriously, fuck you, Tim. I remember when you publicly chastised the police for obeying stand-down orders from lefty mayors and governors, yet I know for a fact that you quite often held back from conveying your own genuine viewpoints and reporting vital information to your own avid followers out of fear of sabotaging your own bankroll. I mean, we do share acquaintances, and at least the majority of cops in this country have small mouths to feed, so what's your excuse? Because of this lack of alt media options in the early 2000s, I had no other choice but to return to my beloved blue-collar roots and make my living, once again, in heavy manual labor, as my forefathers did, with the difference being that I now have student loans to pay, close to the six-figure range. 20 years ago, the corporate media worked unanimously and in concert, and in tandem with the United States government, just to give little Georgie W. his fucking war by either peddling lies to the American public or to purposely omit inconvenient facts from the public discourse. And I, who became so disillusioned with our society's traditional institutions, originally created for the purpose of safeguarding the public from the demagoguery and propaganda necessary for tyranny to take hold, well, it was shortly after getting blacklisted that I became radicalized, and I affiliated myself with an anarchist group that had devolved into what is now Antifa today. Our banking masters, along with their government puppets, made a killing off that fiat-funded quagmire, and it was a testament to their ability in turning any fabricated crisis into a profitable one, provided you can convince the peasant classes to willingly accept the cost through their life and liberty for some hackneyed greater good, be it to the tune of patriotism under Bush or to some social justice cause under Obama. Within the span of 30 years, from President Nixon to Bush Jr., the American press, both in newspaper and broadcasting mediums alike, originally comprised of thousands of independently owned companies, became majority owned by three international firms who were also financially linked to those that negotiated the defense contracts and supply chains that made the Iraq War a very profitable venture. Think things have gotten any better for us 20 years later? Many who have architected that war also had a hand in both the manufacturing of the Wuhan virus and the consequential lockdowns and vax mandates, all of them profitable for a few dynastic families and their white-collared mercenaries, and with the bill falling into the laps of your children's children. But in order to not end this video on a cynical or even fatalistic note, I implore you to keep the faith, in hopes that the truth will always find its way to the light, and because of this, liberty will always have a chance to prevail, especially in an age when information is exchanged worldwide and instantaneously decentralized to such a degree that gatekeeping is next to impossible. Yes, the old ways of boomer journalism, defined by celebrities like Bob Woodward, who cannot help but interject their own damn egos into the story, well, that may be long gone, and it's probably for the best. But don't assume that the traditional libertine principles of journalism are dead, for there are thousands of honorable journalists working hard today to provide the public, or at least the more patriotic of interested parties, with vital information that could potentially save us all from those corrupted officials that are desperately trying to rule every facet of our lives. These journalists, they are anonymous. They are unpaid, unsung, and unwilling to compromise their mission, for their reward is a spiritual one, not a glamorous one. They are sorting through thousands of leaked documents. They are speaking directly to defiant insiders, and they are disseminating meme-worthy information throughout many untraceable channels. The new face of journalism is the most beautiful thus far, for it doesn't actually have one.